Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's always a privilege to welcome to the Salieri Report Franklin Sanders. And our topic today is a free and inspired life, because Franklin and I, about a month ago, were ruminating on what it entailed to try and have a free and inspired life and all the obstacles that we were struggling with. So we figured you're probably struggling with them too, and so we thought we would do so. So Franklin, welcome to the Salieri Report.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being here.
Well, you're somebody who has certainly used all your powers and all your might to try and have an free, inspired life. So, and you've taught me a great deal about how to do it. So, so it's appropriate that we should be talking about it. Well, let's start a free and inspired life. What does that mean to you, Franklin?
Well, freedom involves a certain mental freedom as well. In other words, you're not going to be free if you, for instance, if you're measuring yourself by everyone else's standards. So there's a certain independence of standard that you have to start off with. In other words, if I'm going to judge myself by the criterion of Wall Street, say, or middle class America, then I'm not really free, because those are not standards that I set for myself, so to speak. And the fact is that so much of what goes on in the world is aimed at making you conform to the world standard. That's not always bad, but it may be if it's not what you want to do and what you want to be. So I think standard is the first question you have to answer. What's my standard for my life? And you call that, as we talked, taking responsibility. That means,
right,
I decide that my purpose is my purpose. I can't be but one thing, right? I mean, well, maybe one or two things, but I can't be a thousand things. I can't be all things to all people. And so I have to admit, look, I'm not going to be a really great concert pianist. I'm not going to be a nuclear physicist. I'm not going to be a great hairdresser. I'm going to be what I am. And you have to start out there and be satisfied with that. Otherwise,
right. I think you have to be attracted to your purpose. And I think the important word is attraction, because I think you have to, you know, have a desire to do what it is, or to be what you want to be and to do what you want to do. I think for me that one of the defining qualities of taking responsibility for being free was understanding. You know, I was born into a world that was very totalitarian, where people believed in slavery and controls were very invasive and tight. And it's interesting. I thought that was unique to the world I was born into, and because it seemed to me like everybody else was running around thinking they were free. Mm-hmm. And I've spent my whole life watching the people around me sort of be moved into the world into which I was born. And I think, it's important, if you want to be free, to understand that there are a lot of forces arrayed to make sure you're not.
A lot of those are unconscious, though. That's what I meant by standards. You know, there are a lot of those things are unconscious. For instance, I mean, I'll use myself as an example. Most people would say, you're crazy to move out in the country. Why would you do that? Why would you leave the city and all the conveniences of the city? You see, that's loaded with presuppositions.
Right.
All kinds of presuppositions. And you have to learn to recognize those presuppositions and say, well, wait a minute. I have to take this road because that's the only way I can get to the thing that I'm attracted to. And,
right,
you know, you mentioned the word attraction. I think not only do you have to – I think attraction is the first step of finding your purpose. Just like attraction is the first step of finding a person you love, the second step is love. You know,
right,
attraction is kind of superficial, but when you go deeper and you find, I'm crazy about this, whatever this is, then that's the necessary next step. And unless you love unless you love your purpose, you'll never be very good at it.
Right. Right. And I also think, you know, because to me, being free in a battle zone is different than being free in a free world. And I think you have to be in love. You know, it's not enough to be against totalitarianism. You have to be for something. And for me, my focus on a free and inspired life is because it's what I'm for. I get a real kick out of helping somebody get freer.
Yes.
It just gives me, you know, you do too. I've watched you with your customers and your subscribers, and you get a kick out of helping somebody, you know, learn how to be, you know, whether it's taking care of their money or taking care of their health. You get a kick out of seeing somebody go free. And it's like letting a bird out of a cage. And I do too.
But it also makes my world better.
Right.
You know, I don't want to live in a world inhabited by slaves who
right.
refuse to think for themselves. I want to be inhabited in that exciting world where there are free people who are coming up with new things themselves that I have no idea about, you know, who are,
right.
who are
well, you know,
inventing
it's
and creating themselves.
One of my favorite lines in scripture is, where two or more are gathered in my name, there am I. And mm-hmm. there's something about being in accord with a whole group of people who are committed to free and inspired that
yes.
expands your space. So the more people who are doing it, the easier and the more powerful it is for me to do it, the more I
right.
have to work with. Yeah.
Right. The opposite is also true. That,
right.
that if you're the more people that are around you who are slaves, the harder it is to be free. And that's one of the reasons why you have to stay away from those people. You have to be able to identify those people and stay away from them.
Stay away.
Because,
right.
as you say, they suck all your energy out of you, which is true. It's true.
We know it's funny. Go ahead.
I can't spend my life explaining to these people fundamental presuppositional things that they ought already to understand. I'm not being arrogant. I'm really not.
No, I
there's
listen.
Not enough time. I'm going to be dead before I get that done.
You know, part of me, I have a dear friend who says, well, you need it to have a picture of that. And as you know, I agree completely on the love and on the attraction. But I also think you need a nuts and bolts picture that it's possible. Sometimes people will say to me, oh, you're being a Pollyanna. And I'll quote Carolyn Casey when I say, our circumstances are far too dire for the luxury of realism. Because I've got to have that picture and I've got to be working on creating it or else it's not going to happen.
That's true. But I think too about, let me add something to that about that picture. The scripture again says that God can do above all we can think or ask or imagine. And my experience has been, my picture is always way too small.
Yep.
Way too small.
I couldn't agree more.
And
right.
when when I get to the point where the picture is taking on reality, where the vision is taking on reality, the reality is so much better than I thought it would ever
right.
be.
I agree. I always find that I think small, too small. The other thing I wanted to bring up, you know me and my bucket of no whining buttons. You know, if we're going to have a free and inspired life, we're going to have to do it in the world the way it is. And so we have to find a way of creating it, building it, of loving it, you know, in the world as it is. And so that means, you know, and the reality is we're living in a world where the forces are ready to make sure that we're not free and inspired or mighty and growing stronger by the day. So, or at least that's the way it looks. So it's very important to accept that. That's the environment we've been given to work with, and no whining. Though, you know, I occasionally fall into it.
Well, you know, my grandmother used to say, forewarned is forearmed.
Right.
If you're forewarned that the world's going to be unfair, then you won't waste any time complaining about it. You'll find
right.
a way around it. You know, I think
right.
what free people do is they find a way around the roadblocks. They find a way to climb over or go around the roadblocks. And then they reach that world that they're looking for, you know. And they don't have any time to waste whining. mean, it is a waste of time. And I know, and I say that as a person who is really prone to wine. my wife can tell you, I'm really bad about whining. But, you know, it's a waste of time.
It is a waste of time. The moment I got it was when I was dealing with very serious physical harassment in Washington in 98. And I went to church, and the co-pastor was giving the sermon, and she had a head of steam worked up. She was really aggravated about something. And she said, "The devil can have my car. He can have my house. He can have my job, but he cannot have my joy." And it was almost like, oh yeah, I have permission to be happy no matter what.
Yeah.
And that I decide that, not anyone else. And that's my anointing. That's, you know, that's my, I have that. It's, you know, one of my favorite.
That has to be part of your picture.
Yes.
It doesn't do any good if the picture only brings you misery. And
you can, and you have the right, and you have the power to be in a state of joy no matter what. So,
but you have to work at it.
Oh, yeah.
We think of feelings as being automatic, or we think of feelings as leading. Feelings don't lead. Feelings follow. That is, feelings result from the things we do. And so if we do the things that give us joy, we're going to have joy. If we do the things that make us miserable, we're going to be wretched. And if we do the things that have no point and get us nowhere, we're going to be despairing. And so,
well, I'll tell you where I struggled. It was when I realized I came to a point in the late 90s where I believed, just looking as a portfolio strategist to everything that was going on with the food, with the geoengineering spraying, with all the different things, that there was a depopulation effort underway. And what I said, I sat down and I said, can I be happy? Can I stay alive and be happy in this? And that was a struggle for me, because I can deal with somebody doing things to me, but I struggle with watching other people being harmed. That really upsets me. And I feel powerless. And so the struggle for me is, can I live in a world where this kind of, you know, evil is going on and still have that joy? And that was what I had to sort out in my mind. And it took me a while. It took me a while to reconcile that I could do it.
But that's where faith comes in.
Right.
I mean, you know, faith sees the unseen, and what is unseen in that, what you see in that situation, is the injustice and the murder, and the incredible demonic hatred that motivates the murder, the terrible perversion of humanity that makes us want to rule others and to kill others, and if you don't have faith that God will bring all these things to justice, then you're just lost. You're in a random universe. I mean, this is where I started. This is where I was converted, was that not that I believed in God, but that I was convinced that the devil existed. There was an event, and I was a grown man, you know, I was 34 years old. There was an event that convinced me of the reality of evil, a spirit of evil in the world. And I was in the most terrible position possible, because I believed in evil, but I believed also that there was no protection from it. And so I was alone. And you know, just imagine for 24 hours trying to protect yourself. Can't go to sleep.
Right.
Can't go to sleep, because your watchfulness is all that stands between you and destruction, and your family and destruction. And that's the most miserable place possible.
Right. If you've ever faced pure evil, then you know to be respectful and afraid of it.
Oh, I wasn't making light of it. Right. I don't mean that
right.
at all.
Right. No, I know.
But this is the reason why. Once you see that evil, once you get a glimpse of that evil, then you realize I've got to have protection somewhere. I can't do this by myself. And it's not, I'm not being Manichaean. I'm not saying, well, there's a spirit of evil in the world and there's a spirit of good and one balances the other out. No, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying there's a God who rules events so that he eventually will do justice, even though he may delay a long time for reasons of his own that we can't understand. That without that, then the world becomes just random. Right. Or worse, a struggle between good and evil where everything good is impotent and unable to actually eliminate evil. And I mean, that's the whole hope of Christianity is that evil's been overcome and will be overcome. So that's where I think faith comes in, that you know, it doesn't matter how much I sweat and bleed today, in the end, God will bring it all right.
Right.
And if that's not true.
We're going to get back to faith. But
yeah.
So we started with taking responsibility as number one. So you're responsible for your free and inspired life. Number two that I wanted to talk about was building a reliable map. And that was, in fact, one of the things that has always drawn me to the Money Changer in your work, because you're there digging. You're like a miner. You're digging for truth. I find it helps tremendously to have a reliable understanding of the world to the extent that we can get it. I think, you know, I feel there's still a great deal that I don't understand and I keep trying to, but at least I've got a framework for the certainty, for the uncertainty.
Right.
Anyway, so maybe if we could talk about building a reliable map.
Well, I think a reliable map goes back to what we were talking about earlier about purpose, that there are a lot of unreliable maps that the world sells.
Right.
There are a lot of unreliable maps. I mean, I was thinking about yesterday. Janet Yellen gets up, and she makes these pronouncements that are basically the same thing that she's been saying for a year. There's
right.
nothing new about what she said. And there are actually people who hang on her words. as if these were the words, this was the oracle from heaven, and this is what will happen. Well, actually, number one, the words say nothing. Number two, she doesn't have that kind of power. In the first place, she couldn't run a Louisiana snow cone stand in the summer at a profit because she never had to work for a living. You know, she never had to show a profit. But more than that, they don't have that much power. The Fed doesn't have that much power. They've got power to screw up things, but they don't have power. At least
they do have power in this sense. In other words, you've got a huge amount of paper just piled up high in the bond market, mm-hmm. and everybody's waiting for that money to start to shift, because as soon as it does, you're going to get very significant gappings and pricings, and nobody wants to try and trade it before it starts. But
right.
they're all waiting for it to start. And you're talking about the repricing of trillions and trillions of dollars. And so she's the person who's speaking for the machinery. And everybody knows when the machinery moves, big money's going to be made and lost.
Right. But the point I was trying to make was this is a machinery I don't want to be part of.
Right.
This is a machinery that really doesn't affect my life. This is a machinery. I mean, I understand you're saying it affects markets. I understand all that, but it doesn't have to affect me. I don't have to be dependent on her. I don't have to be dependent on what she says. I don't have to be dependent on the Fed. And once I figure that out, then I can look at all those people who are hanging on every word that comes off her mouth, and I can laugh because
right.
I realize that that the largest part of the delusion is their self-delusion. It's not just the Fed, like the Wizard of Oz, pulling all the smoke and the smoke machine and the mirror machine, but it's the belief that we give those people. It's giving them. It's believing that our life and our prosperity depends on the Fed. Once you get free of that. Once you get the right roadmap, you realize, look, those people can do whatever they want to do, but I'm going to keep going in my road, and I'm going to create the world in my little world. I'm going to create the economy that I want, and I'm going to just deal with those people who want that kind of economy.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, but they're engineering a money machine that's you know, that's fluctuating. And it's like we're swimming in an ocean and the waves are fluctuating back and forth, and you need to be able to navigate that. And there's a great deal you can do to build your life and your economic life so that you are as immune as possible. But you need to know it's going on. So, you know, I think the waves are rolling through. If you look at how what they do and how, if you look at the two things right now they're doing that are driving the housing market, you know, throughout all the people listening, you know, how buy or sell or own homes just in the process of moving around and living, and if those waves are coming through, they need to know it. So I think you need to be cognizant of it, and I think you have to try and build your life so that your wealth build steadily without being rolled by that machine. And, you know, but you need to understand that machine and make sure you can duck it when the wave goes by. You need a surfboard. Okay, well, that takes us to economic wealth, because I think, you know, I think the hardest thing is how do you build economic wealth in an environment where, you know, part of, you know, we really have what I would call friendly fascism, you know, because everything is trying. The control systems are very invisible. And one of the most important control systems, of course, is money, trying to get you to sort of jump for the what you call the treats of the tapeworm. So, you know, and you're somebody who's spent a lifetime trying to build economic wealth that's truly independent. So maybe if you could say a few things about how do you go about doing that?
Well, you know, I don't have any keys to that. But the real key, I think, is to make yourself as indispensable as you possibly can be. Nobody, of course, is irreplaceable. But once you get a level, once you acquire a level of skill and understanding high enough, then you become more or less indispensable to the people that you're doing business with. In other words, if I get enough value out of doing business with you, then that justifies my doing business with you. And if I get more value out of doing business with you than I would get from anyone else I could do the same thing with, then I'm going to go to you. So, and there's plenty of room. You know, one of the things that people have to understand about markets is there's plenty of room in every market for competition. I mean, there's plenty of room. You don't have to monopolize the whole market. There's plenty of room, no matter what you do. But I think that building that skill that will make you indispensable. In other words, your goal, if you were an employee, your goal would be to be the last person laid off.
Right.
Right. That, and you know so much about the operation of the business, you could step into any seat and fill that seat. So you're going to be the last person laid off. Well, it's the same way when you work for yourself. You're going to be so valuable to the folks you do business with that you'll be the last person they lay off. I mean, in my business, I don't try to be, and I'm sure you feel this way too, I don't try to be the cheapest person in the market. If somebody else wants to be Walmart, let them. But
right.
what I do is more valuable than that. And, you know, it's not just a question of price. It's a question of leadership and knowledge that you give to people who are ignorant in a field.
Right.
And you bring to them, because just that knowledge will probably save them many more times than what they pay you.
Well, what I find a couple of things are useful. You know, if I come out to Top of the World Farm and I start talking to you or Susan or people in your family, everybody's learning something new. You're always learning. You're always looking for new knowledge. And it's not just on how to do something in your business. It's how to do something for yourself. So, you know, you guys have taught yourself how to farm. You've taught yourself how to build houses. You've taught yourself how to, you know, do all sorts of natural home remedies. In other words, you're constantly looking for ways of getting the best quality services in a way where you can do it yourself. And even if you don't do it yourself, even if you get somebody else to do it, then you're a very knowledgeable consumer.
Right.
So you kind of go at the world with an attitude, I can learn anything.
Well, if I can't, my kids can. How about that?
Right, right. And I think that's where, you know, because you have a big family, having a big family of curious people, you know, can really be a force multiplier. Another thing I wanted to mention was the importance of network. I think, you know, what I've seen is it's very, very important to build whatever you do around people who are the kind of people that are aligned with you. So one of the things I love about doing the Soleria Report is if you look at my subscribers, they're fabulous people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm much more aligned with them in terms of values and ethics than I was when I worked, you know, in Washington. So the more you can work with people who share your values, share your interests, share your whatever, and the more you can align with your customers, I think the better job you can do. The last thing is, I think it's very important in creating economic wealth to find very specific, whether it's a practice or a business, very specific practical things you can do for other people. You know, so making an independent business is very bottom up. It's not a conceptual thing. You know, you've got to get in the trenches and do something. And it's interesting. I don't know if you know how I ended up starting the Soleria Report, but I just decided in the 90s that I was so angry at the Washington Post for doing its latest dirty thing that I said, from now on, I'm not going to talk to reporters. I'm just going to talk to people who, you know, I'm going to answer questions of people. Communicate directly. And one thing led to another, and the questions became overwhelming. And that's how I ended up starting the investment advisory business. And then the Soleria Report, all I was trying to do was answer the questions. So, you know, and that meant years and years of trying to serve people without being paid for it. But it evolved from there because that's what people wanted from me. So,
well, you know, let me add something about this before we leave it, before we leave this topic. You attract the kind of people you want. I mean, of course, there are always going to be clods that come into your life and that drag you down and annoy you. But what I mean by that is if you are the kind of person you want to be, you will attract the kind of people you want to attract.
Right.
You follow what I'm saying? I mean, I feel the same way about my customers that you do about your clients.
Right.
Somehow or the other, I just think the world of these
people. Wonderful people.
Yeah. And,
yeah, wonderful
you know, the
people.
Rest of the world thinks, oh, there's nobody like that left out here. Well, shoot.
Yes, there are.
My customers are that kind of people. So you attract what you are. Likes, I know it's supposed to be said that opposites attract, but in this case, likes attract.
Yeah. Okay, building health. Because I find where the economic formula breaks down is people get sick. You know, it's poor health is the number one cause of bankruptcy, number one cause of financial problems. You know, if people have a bad attitude, it's because they're struggling with health. And as you know, I think a part of the effort to institute friendly fascism is to do a series of things with whether it's food, vaccines, you know, different kinds of health care that really do diminish people's health and make them easier to control. So let's turn to health because I know even though your business is precious metals, you know, and economics and the money changer, you spend a lot of time on health. In fact, you put together a compendium of all your health interviews that's, to me, you know, one of the most excellent things I've ever read on health. And your focus has been very much on things that people can do with each other, do for themselves. So talk a little bit about how did you come on to that? When did you decide you were your own doctor?
Well, you know, these people kind of just sort of came into my life. And part of that is that reliable map we were talking about before. And one of my reliable maps about people is that often people who are doing the best work are under the heaviest fire. I mean, the way I got to know Jonathan Wright back in 1991, the FDA that had wanted to put him out of business, you know, wanted to disrupt him. Jonathan Wright is probably, well, he's certainly one of the top nutritional physicians in the world who treats various conditions with nutrition. I mean, there's just nobody, there are very few people comparable to him. And he was attacked by the FDA. They came in and raided his office. They stole all his patient records. And when I'm talking about a clinic that was, at that time, I think it was three or four stories high, you know, a three or four story building in Seattle. And usually what happens is that the people the FDA attacks, like all the people the government attacks, you know about this, they just go down in flames because everybody runs away from them, and they're cut out of the herd and left to defend themselves alone. Well, in Jonathan's case, there was a talk show radio host, a drive-time talk show radio host, who picked up on what had happened to him, and he began to have Jonathan on and suggested that people call their Washington representatives and senators about it. And then alternative health groups on the West Coast picked it up, and there was such an outcry that the FDA backed off. By the way, you know what they were accusing him?
Which is unheard of. It's just unheard of. That's pretty amazing.
Oh, I know it was. What, you know what they were accusing him of? They said he was using impure vitamin B12. Well, he was importing the B12. Yeah, listen, he was importing the B12 from Germany. Now, how likely do you think...
No way the Germans are going to have impure anything.
I know. It's just crazy. It was nuts. But anyway, he survived that. And you know, he's still under attack. And if you go to any of these websites like Quackwatch or Wikipedia or anything like that, though, right, you'll read about him and you think that this guy ought to be in prison. And it's just lies. All of it is lies. And that's kind of a pretty good – it's not 100%, but it's a pretty good – guide that this person is doing some pretty important work.
If you're going to have a free and inspired life in America, one of the things you need to understand is there are literally hundreds of millions of dollars spent for trolls to go through the internet and disrupt and write and attack and smear. It's one of the biggest job programs in America. And your tax dollar at work.
Let me say something about that. I went through all this criminal trial. You went through criminal accusations from the government, and you know that an artistic prosecuting attorney, and they're all artistic in this wicked respect.
Yeah, they just make stuff up.
Oh, they make stuff up, and they make you look like the awfulest person in the world. And what I found, this has been 15 years ago, more than 15 years ago, somehow or the other, at some point, I looked up my name on the web, on the internet, which is a very bad thing to do. And I found all of this stuff, a lot of it by Christian people, about what an awful person I was and how I didn't pay my taxes and yak yak. And I was cut to the soul. I was so hurt that my reputation had been spoiled. Do you know what I learned from that?
What?
Never, ever, ever spend even 1 second justifying yourself. Never spend 1 second justifying yourself. That's as bad a waste of time. That's a worse waste of time than whining. You know, it's like trying to teach a pig to sing. The pig can't do it, and it just annoys the pig. It's a waste of your time, and it annoys the pig. If you're a responsible person and you know that you're right, I'm not talking about not listening to criticism, but when you come across these people who just are trying to destroy your reputation and who don't have a clue what's going on, like these people who on Wikipedia who blackened Dr. Gonzalez in what they say and it with nothing but lies, you can't waste your time on people like that. You just have to say,
well, there's something else. It gets back to, you know, taking responsibility.
Yeah.
In other words, if you want to have a free and inspired life, that's a big job, and you need to focus all your energy on making that pathway for yourself, and you don't have time to lob back attacks on defense contractors who are being paid to attack you. What you need to do is you just need to keep your eye on the ball, because right. that's just a distraction, and you cannot afford to lose your time on distraction. When, you know, if I'm whining back at a defense contractor troll, that's, you know, that's 10 minutes I'm not spending doing something serving the people who pay me to serve them.
Well, goodness and gracious, you could spend that time rearranging your sock drawer, and you'd be spending it way better than spending your time justifying yourself before people.
Well, don't laugh. You know, when things got so bad during the litigation that I literally couldn't, you know, it's so bad you can't even get up and move across the room, I would have a list of things to do, mm-hmm. you know, on the theory that if I just did something, then, you know, it would give positive momentum. And the thing that I would do when things were just completely hopeless and I couldn't do a thing is I'd clean my closets.
I understand. There's a little bit of feedback in creating order in the world. I got
right,
you.
Exactly. Okay, so back to health. How did you build the incredible knowledge that you and Susan have of health? How did you do that?
You know, when I was growing up, I'll give my parents credit for this. They were very interested in alternative health, and they were, they cultivated that sort of stuff. They subscribed to organic gardening. I mean, I know that magazine doesn't sound like much, but it was very.
Believe it or not, I subscribed to organic gardening.
To what?
I subscribed to organic gardening.
Yeah, I mean, there was just a huge amount of knowledge there. And then, I got older, and for some reason, again, I guess, you know, God sends you the people you're supposed to know. I would meet a lot of these people who were doing these alternative things, some of them before they got into trouble with the government. And I was just fascinated to learn about the things that they did, because, you know, it would be a mistake. It would be a terrible mistake to say that orthodox medicine, mainstream medicine, doesn't offer any good things. It does. I mean, Susan.
It does. Yeah.
Susan had heart surgery back in 2008, 2012. I mean, that's the kind of thing that orthodox mainstream medicine does really well. But there are other things, especially, and I have a brother who's a physician. I know a lot of physicians who will say the same thing that I'm about to say. Pharmaceuticals have taken over medicine, and it's not the best path. You know, there are a lot of simple things that you can do that the whole pharmaceutically inclined mainstream medicine would sneer at. I'll give you one example, vitamin C. In 1947, there was a doctor who was curing polio with intravenous vitamin C, and he was doing it in 4 days.
Wow.
And this has been going on for years and years and years. I mean, there's a 1950 or 53 report about the cancer industry that was made to Congress, in which the person who made the report says alternative cures are being suppressed. This is a big, long testimony that went into the congressional record and that was given, I think it was in 1953. So this has been going on a long, long time. And one of the things that, you know, I don't believe most doctors want to hurt their patients. I believe most people who are physicians or nurses or whatever, they go into that profession because they want to help people.
Right.
But by the same token, you know, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so
before you go to doctors or hospitals or healthcare providers, you know, you're responsible to make sure you're healthy. And that's a whole lot of stuff and a whole lot of work and a whole lot of investment, you know, that has nothing to do with, you know, that's not what what doctors and hospitals and nurses do.
No, they're intervention when there's a problem.
Right.
But they're not, they're not there to, or they don't put very much emphasis on staying well. And that's the place that I think that you have to really, really pay attention.
The reason I bring this up, and I just want to say this before we move on, is one of the things that first happened to me when I became an investment advisor is I had people who had significant financial resources telling me they couldn't afford to do a whole variety of things they needed to protect their health and to build their health, including eating really high quality food.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, if you just looked at their balance sheet and financial statements, what I understood was they could not afford to do that. You know, that it, as a financial matter, it was imperative that they do that. And, you know, because other, and they weren't integrating their financial state, you know, they weren't integrating their financial capital with their living capital. And we need a vision of how to do that. That is, you know, we just need a vision of how to do that, because if you look at how the system works, the machine does everything it can to give you, you know, to get you to put your resources into the machine and not put it into yourself. And whether it's your education or building skills or building health or protecting your health and eating good food, you need a balance between maintaining financial assets and maintaining living assets, which are in you. Okay, so the next one is navigating incentive systems. And I just have to say that when you first came up with the expression, forsaking the treats of the tapeworm,
yeah,
it completely changed my life, because it identified one of the things I've most struggled with my whole life. And that is, you know, the system, so we'll call the sort of, I used to call the negative return on investment system the tapeworm. But the system is constantly handing out little pet treats, and you have so many people who are like hamsters on a wheel, and they're just constantly playing for tiny little treats of the tapeworm. And of course, the people who are the most dangerous in the society are not the people who are engineering the totalitarian system. The people are your neighbors who are pining for the treats of the tapeworm.
Well,
so maybe if you could explain all of that.
Well, let me give you an analogy. I've been reading a book by a fellow named Schatzker called The Dorito Effect.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't gotten very deep into it, but his point is this. Beginning in the mid-1950s, there was a revolution in food processing whereby all of this artificial flavoring was used in food. And the fact is that flavor is the one thing that your physical being really pays attention to.
Right.
Almost more than anything else is, does it taste good? But your taste buds, your flavor sensors cannot tell the difference between a real taco and a chemically flavored taco chip. And so the problem, if you look around in the United States, you know that there is some kind of health problem and that it's a nutritional problem, because you've got masses of obese people, masses of people with diabetes because they have so much sugar in their diets and so forth. Well, how do you get healthy? You have to overcome the attraction of artificial flavors.
Right.
You have to learn to say, no, I want the real thing. I want that chicken that doesn't taste like cardboard. I want that chicken that tastes real. And,
right,
you know, if you search out the real flavors, that is the real treats, the real prizes in this world, you won't be distracted by the artificial prizes or the treats of the tapeworm. It's just that simple. So, I realize it's hard to do, because the artificial flavor has one goal, and that is to fool your taste buds into thinking it really is a taco.
Except for this, I have to say, you know, as somebody who has been on that treadmill and gotten a lot of treats from the tapeworm, it's wonderful having beautiful homes and great artwork and driving a Ferrari, and, you know, those things are very real. And it's wonderful never having to worry about money, and you know, there are a lot of those treats are very concrete and very wonderful. And you know, I've struggled to pay the overhead. It's wonderful to never have to struggle to pay the overhead, because you're just, you know, the money's pouring in. It feels great.
All right, just let me go back to my analogy.
Okay.
The taco-flavored Doritos taste really good, but the cost, the price that I pay for them, not the price for buying them, but the price of my body that I pay for consuming nothing but stuff like that, that's artificial flavor and no nutrition, the price is too high to pay. In the same sense, in the same respect, the price that I have to pay for the tapeworm's treats, for those, that Ferrari, is too high. I won't pay that.
Well, except, you know, so let me be a skeptic. There was, if you look at the work I did, you know, I loved the work I did. I was, what I did on Wall Street was I really found a way to make things go. So the New York City subway system was in real trouble and was undercapitalized, and everyone said it couldn't, you know, nine firms said it couldn't be recapitalized, and our firm said it was, it could be, but then they figured that, you know, we would fail on most of it and just get the stuff that would work. So they took all the stuff that they knew would fail and they gave it to a girl because she was expendable, right? And that was wonderful. That was fun because you were, you know, I did most of my work on Wall Street was great stuff. And, you know, there was room then when you could still be in the middle of the road. And the reality was, you know, if you look at what I was doing at FHA for the first 18 months, it was great stuff. If you look at what I was doing in Hamilton, it was great stuff. The problem became, you know, in the 90s, a clear genocide plan rolled out, and I didn't want to be part of it. And you know, and so the middle of the road went away. And I think that's been happening to a lot of people who were, you know, they were playing in that sector that was the middle of the road, and now it's being slowly, you know, pulled from under their feet, and they got to choose one side or the other.
But see, you're coming back to the price. What is the price of the treat? You're telling me that there came a point when the price of the treat changed and it became too expensive for you to pay. You didn't want to be part of a genocidal system. So that's the price. And you, the problem is the treats of the tapeworm don't always come with a price tag on them.
Right.
You have to.
Well,
you know,
I always thought there was kind of a
building.
I always thought there was a way, you know, because people always told me in the system that the reason we do what we do is the crowd will never support the responsible, you know, solution. So I thought, well, I'll just come out with I'll figure out how we can reoptimize and create enough wealth that the crowd will support it and everybody, you know, will have the win-win solution. Well, it turns out they didn't want that. Anyway. But I think, you know, to me, the struggle I have, Franklin, is not with, you know, I understand Mr. Global to a certain extent, what he wants, where he's going. And to him, it's business. It's not personal. You know, it's kind of a business thing. And I understand we don't see eye to eye, and it is what it is. What I struggle with is people around me who pine for the treats of the tapeworm. Almost, you know, I almost feel like I'm dealing sometimes with you know, mental zombies who just, you know, if Harvard will make them an offer, it's just like their brain turns off and off they go. That's really what they want. They want the treats of the tapeworm. And so what I have to do is I just have to say, look, you go your way, I go mine. You know, we have to separate. And many people in my life who I've loved, I've just had to separate with because whether they're doing, you know, whether because they're pining for the treats of the tapeworm or as a result they're doing unethical things that harm people, I just don't want to, you know, I have to say goodbye.
Well, but that's part of responsibility, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
That's
I think the most
person does is you don't stay around irresponsible people.
Right.
You recognize what they are and admit it, and then you take action. You know, one of the worst things you can possibly do is to live with constant irritations in your life that where you know you ought to do something about them, but you just let them go on and you just keep suffering the irritation.
Okay, so that brings us to building community. How do we, in the middle of this, how do you build community? And, you know, it's funny because if you look at your life and my life, we've taken opposite strategies on doing it. So you have a wildly successful marriage and you're surrounded by a family and you've sort of built a community with many of them. Whereas I'm decided to be completely alone and, you know, wander the world, you know, sort of as a nomad and you know, networking with lots of people, but very much taking the, you know, free to move path. So let's start with you. How do you do it?
You know, I'm really not happy that you're asking me this because I'm afraid I don't have a really good answer that other people can apply. I mean, I could say all sorts of lofty things, but I think the first thing is that you know, in a marriage you make an unwithdrawable commitment to somebody. And right. If you think about the marriage ceremony says, look, I'm going to stick by you when you're attractive and when you're not attractive, when you're sick, when you're healthy, when you're old, whatever it is. And a lot of that stuff you don't even realize what you're getting into, like, you know, two people 20 years old getting married, do they know what it's like to be 68 years old and all the problems you have then? No, of course they don't. But I think you have to have that commitment before anything else begins. And it's that same thing sort of carries on over into the people that you're not related to. I mean, at a different level, of course. But you have to have that kind of commitment to each other that says, look, we're both going to be here, we're both going to be living here, and we're both going to remain in love with each other. And I say that also applying to your neighbors. I mean, not just to your family and your wife or husband. So that commitment, I think, is the first thing. The second thing is, you're not alone. You have a huge community of people around the world. I mean, right. I understand what you're saying. You know, you live alone, but you also have a huge community of people around the world who right. share your values and who are working towards somewhat the same end that you are. And right. I think the thing that we have to understand is, there is no such thing as a lone human being. Yeah. You know, the rugged individualist is a terrible, terrible idea. You when you do that, you will wind up alone and unloved. And unless you let other people into your life, and that means taking a risk on them, you let other people into your life and make them part of your community, bring them into your community. And that, of course, takes a positive action. You know, it's not enough. You know the old story about the fellow who'd been married. He was 80 years old. He'd been married to his wife for 50 years. And on their wedding anniversary, she got upset because he never told her he loved her. And he said, she came up to him and said, you know, we got married. You remember we got married 50 years ago today? He said, yep, sure do. She said, you know, and you told me you loved me. And that's the last time you've said it. He said, yep, but when I change my mind, I'll let you know. Well, you can't do people that way. You know, you have to sort of constantly be checking on people and saying, you know, I love you still. I still see you. I still am concerned for you. And if you don't have that community, you just can't function.
But you have to invest. You have to invest in people.
Yeah.
And you have to invest in people, and it's just like investing in stocks. You know, they're not all going to work out, but you got to keep investing.
And it works back the other way too. You know, there's a proverb in the scripture that says iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. I need other people around me to keep me in line. Right. I need other people around me to say to me, as you so often do, you got that part wrong. You're wrong about that. You hadn't thought that through. Well, I mean, every one of us needs that. And you know, the smarter and the more independent we are, the more we need that. And that's what community does. But also community right. multiplies your force. It multiplies
yes.
your power.
It
gives you leverage. And
yes.
that's the way, anyway, we were created to live, in community with other people. You know, we're not reptiles that live alone in the rocks. We're not herd animals, but we're social animals. There's no question about that.
Okay, so let me run through quickly what I call risk management, which are the traps. Because I have to tell you, you know, a lot of life comes down to time and money.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can avoid the traps, because the traps are sinkholes that steal your time and steal your money. So let's talk about them. One of them, the first one, which I think is unbelievably important, is the power of habits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot of life comes down to good habits versus bad habits. And if you get the good habits you're in great shape. If you get bad habits, you're in real trouble. And one of the things I admire so much about you and Susan is you really have good habits. You know, you're early to bed, early to rise, up early, working hard. And, you know, if somebody is a slug, wham, they hear those, you know, those little reminders. But so to me, the power of habit is very important. And one of the hardest things of dealing with a tapeworm and dealing with situations like the one you and I are in is they wreak havoc with your habits. And the place I've really struggled is to reassert and maintain those good habits in the face of, you know, you see something terrible happen or something terrible happens to you and you just say, okay, I want to go get a gallon of mint chocolate chip ice cream and watch movies.
Which sometimes is not a bad idea.
Sometimes is not a bad idea, but, you know, there's too much of a good thing.
2 weeks.
Right. So how do you do it? How do you maintain excellent habits?
Well, I think you think our habits are better than they are, but I don't. You know, part of that I think is part of the character that we're born with. I mean, if I say to you, you are a person who won't say quit. I'm just that kind of person. You know, I just won't say
right.
quit. And. Maybe sometimes good habits become bad habits, but part of it is doing what you love. If you're doing what you love, it's not hard to get up and go do it again.
Right.
But there is this terrible. I have a terrible tendency to see some awful thing and to despair and say, well, I'm just gonna, you know, I'm gonna sit on the couch and drink a glass of wine and watch a movie.
Right.
And the more you let things slide, the easier it is to let things slide. And in that sense, you've got to be afraid of yourself.
Okay. Mind control and disinformation. If you look at the education, take education, media, now with the smartphones, the average life in America is expected to consume an enormous amount of disinformation or manipulative influence. And we all get trapped at various times in it. And of course, I've reached the point where I'm saying to people, you just got to homeschool. There's no, you know, your child cannot afford to consume that much disinformation. They don't, you know, they can't afford to spend the time on disinformation. But maybe if you could say a little bit about how to avoid all the disinformation.
You and I have talked about this before, and your phrase is do the math. That is, if something doesn't make sense, it doesn't make sense. Even no matter what the media tell you, no matter what all those sources of disinformation tell you, if something doesn't make sense, it simply doesn't make sense. And, another thing is you can refer your question to other people. That's one of the advantages of having a network of people that you trust and whose judgment you trust. You know, if something doesn't look right, you point it out to them. But I think one of the most important things is unplugging yourself from all that stuff. Back in the 80s, early 80s, I realized every morning when I got up went to work about 10 o'clock, I'd just be madder than a wet wasp, and I couldn't figure out what in the world was it. Was I drinking too much coffee? What was it? I was reading the newspaper. And I said, wait a minute, I'm going to stop reading the newspaper. And I haven't read one since, except, you know, here and there. And it vastly improved my life because all of those stupid stories about people stabbing each other and shooting each other and this, that, and the other, I didn't read any of that anymore. And
right.
So I wasn't subject to that kind of brainwashing and mind control. But it's very, very important that you avoid that sort of stuff. And with children, you know, what we found out homeschooling was that if you can just keep that child by you until the child is 11 or 12, you've done the biggest part of the work. Because by then the child has learned how to look at the world. He's got a fundamental worldview that he won't change, won't deviate from. And he's learned to how to think and ask questions. And if you get him that far, that's, you know, that's the main thing, because otherwise he's going to look at all these sources of disinformation and naively believe them. And what you've taught him to do is don't do that. You know what the truth is. Refer everything to the truth. And if it disagrees, then the lie is a lie.
Okay. The next one is avoiding untrustworthy people and organizations. You know, it's amazing because you can put your money with MF Global and one, you know, in my investment advisory practice, one of the things I do is I help people clean up their, you know, what they've dealt with in terms of financial fraud. And it's amazing how one bad organization can just wreck, you know, steal enormous amounts of time and resources from one life. And so avoiding that bad dog is a big one.
Well, Bernie Madoff was another one, you know. But in both those cases, suddenly people found out that they things were not what they seemed, and they had lost huge amounts of money. But also, you know, you can lose huge amounts of time by devoting yourself to organizations that you think are doing what you want to do, but that don't do what you want to do. And I mean, I've done that. So I think you have to keep that break on yourself that says, is this, you know, does this really identify, does this organization really identify with my goals and my standards?
Right. And what I'm always telling people is take the time to get to know them, you know, be slow and careful about the relationships you create and build and take your time. I will say this. One of the things I've seen is people who get caught up in financial frauds, you know, they have a tendency to either, you know, they're kind of two fact patterns I see. One is they want to be in with the in crowd. They're looking for the inside deal and they know it's there and they want to, you know, and there's that desire to get the inside deal. And they get tricked by it. They get trapped by it. And some of them get tricked about it again and again. Or you got somebody who's following a person like that, thinking that they know something that, you know, I don't know. And the reality is if you can't explain it to a seven-year-old and you can't understand it to that level, then something may be wrong. So,
well, I think there's something else, too, and that is that contradictions don't exist. In other words, if you look at the character of someone, and organizations have a character too, and they do something that's completely out of character with what they claim to be, then they're not trustworthy.
Right.
I mean, it's just like doing business with somebody who is an adulterer. You know, if he cheat on his wife, is he going to cheat on you?
Right.
You don't even have to ask that question. Well, if an organization support something that's completely contrary to integrity, you know, to stay away from it. And of course, there's always the old rule, if it sounds too good to be true, it most certainly is.
Government money and enforcement is one of the next ones. You know, all across the country, we're dealing with the Sheriff of Nottingham. So we have all sorts of different governmental entities who depend on enforcement actions to generate the money they need to meet their overhead. So everybody knows the story of the, you know, of the speed trap, but more and more of the economy is becoming a speed trap. And, you know, it gets very complicated to tell people how to anticipate this. But, you know, one of the most important things you can do in choosing where you live is, you know, one of the reasons I have a base camp in Hickory Valley, Tennessee, is, you know, my combined taxes on three properties are approximately $500 a year. So if they double property taxes, you know, it's not $50,000, it's $1,000, you know, and I know my sheriff and I've got a great sheriff. You know, and my municipality, we have enough reserves so that if we stop collecting taxes, we'd have enough money for 20 years. So, and Tennessee, you and I both live in Tennessee, which is a you know, is a very fiscally conservative state. So,
and has no income tax.
So, you know, I think the only way you can protect yourself against this is be very judicious about where you choose to live, but also keep very, very good records, you know, and be prepared. You know, what I find is all around the country, people are being targeted by this kind of enforcement, and they just have to pay attention and do the work. Whenever something like this happens to me, I immediately jump on it and work it to death and don't let it get started. So I don't know what to say other than, you know, the sheriff of Nottingham is riding, and he's riding not just throughout the United States, but all over the world.
Well, let me turn that around. You know, there's another part of that. You're looking at kind of the negative side of it. Let me look at the positive side of it. That is, there's another aspect of government money, and that is that they offer you this money, and people generally think, oh, it's free money. If I don't bend down and pick it up, somebody else will. Well, the truth is, all government money comes with a sock in the jaw. Right. All government money comes with a sock in the jaw. I mean, I'll give you an example. Physicians over the course of the last 60 years have been trapped in a third party system, a third party payer system, and now they've lost control of their own lives. I mean, they by and large, and the reason is they take government money, and there's a raft of doctors, the American Academy for the Advancement of Medicine, who refuse to take any government money. And the fact is, that's the only way they can be free, because the courts have said over and over and over, if you take any government money at all, any government money, then you have to follow all of their rules. So the way to avoid that is don't take the government money.
Carl Denning had a great article about the other day about a Oklahoma surgical center that only accepts cash. And they charge 20% of the Medicare price, which when you think about it is the deductible on Medicare. It's the equivalent of the deductible. And same with the testing service in Arizona. It's approximately 20% of the Medicare price, but they only take cash. My number one concern is environmental pollution, because I think if you look at what's happening outside of our control, whether it's to the food supply, to the quality of the soil, to the quality of the air, to the quality of the water. You know, we are being bombarded. You know, we're having aluminum sprayed over our heads, and we know what aluminum does to our health. So, you know, and that gets back to the importance of paying attention to your health and being your own doctor. But to me, I think environmental pollution to me is the number one, my number one concern about sort of living a free and inspired life.
Well, last night I was reading an article about glyphosate, which is Roundup, and it's literally everywhere. I mean, even here where I live, on my way home, I go past the farmer's fields, where the two big fields where he grows soybeans and corn, and one year and one the next year, and calls that a crop rotation, which it's not. But he sprays the field in the spring with glyphosate, and then comes back and no-till drills in corn or soybeans. I can't get away from that. On our place here, there has not been a chemical used on this place since 4 or 5 years before we moved here. And anywhere we operate, we never use any kind of chemicals. But you're just exposed to, I mean, glyphosate's in all the processed foods, almost all the processed foods that you get. So how do you avoid it? Well, you know, there's a lot you can do, but you can't be perfect. One of the things that I think helps us is if you have a healthy system, nature's pretty powerful, and nature can overcome a lot of insults. So that's what makes it all the more important that you eat well and try to take care of your health in advance before you get sick. But avoid all of it? I can't, Catherine.
I can't.
And
well, but I, you know, I did a huge detox when the litigation was over. And one of the things I realized as I was doing it is, oh, I'm going to have to do this forever. I'm in the detoxing business forever. Okay, violence and war, violence and war are things you just have to move away from. I don't know any other way to deal with them other than to get as far away from them as you can. But there's no doubt that, you know, you and I live in a primitive society. There's plenty of violence. Luckily, we're not at war.
But I live far enough from town that I don't have to face much of it.
Right.
I mean, I live basically in among old folks. You know, most of the native people that live around here are retired. And so I don't have that problem. But it's nearby. And, it's just there. There's not much I can do about it.
Okay, bad habits. Struggling with bad habits. The ones I listed were self-pity, anger, and grief. And I have to tell you, I have a grief problem. This is one I'm still working on beating because you see something happen, just terrible to somebody, and you just start to grieve.
Well, and I think the grief leads to despair, and the despair, depression. And the root of most of that is self-centeredness. And if we sort of step back and take ourselves out of the center of the picture, then that helps us to restore our perspective. I mean, grief is normal. Grief is right. When evil things happen that you can't do anything about, things that we call tragic, you're not a normal human being. You're a monster if you don't feel sorrow over those things. But by the same token, the grief. That event is not the end. That event is not it does not define what God is doing in the world. It reflects the evil. It reflects the fallen world, but it's not the end. And so,
well, I have to find a composting process for my grief and turn it into energy. So
well,
I'm looking to get better at composting grief. Okay, distraction and aimlessness. This was yours.
Yeah, you know, it's so easy to get to work in your business instead of on your business. It's
right.
The story of the great automobile mechanic. You know, you take a guy who's a great automobile mechanic, and he opens a shop, and what he wants to do is work on cars. He doesn't want to answer phones. He doesn't want to schedule appointments. He doesn't want to order parts, all that stuff. He wants to work on cars. So that's working in his business instead of working on his business. The mechanic who works on his business says, look, I need four other mechanics, and I can quadruple the amount of work I can put through here, and I can pay them a good wage and take a little bit of that and get to do what I want to do, which is work on cars. And I can hire a secretary to take care of all the other stuff. So that the idea is that you work on your business instead of in your business. Otherwise, I mean, this is my personal problem. I get distracted. I love to do my business, and so I get distracted from the other things that take more self-discipline. It's kind of like that eating chocolate chip ice cream and watching movies that you're talking about. And here's the bad part of it. You're actually doing some kind of work, right? So you can just...
Well, the way I've reconciled it is I will only, when I get into a state of despair, I will only watch a movie that I'm considering for the Solari Report. That's how I justify it. Okay, so the most important one, we started with it, but we've got to end with it, and that's faith. Because to me, it all comes down to faith.
Yeah.
And, if you want to live a free and inspired life in this environment, it is a faith walk, and you have got to have that faith. And this is something I struggle with as to how to explain to people, because I know the process of where my faith came from. But understanding where my faith came from tells me not one thing about how to help another person find theirs. We each have to find this, you know, it's a It's a unique thing to each person.
Well, I think there's usually some experience that precipitates it. Some experience of powerlessness, some experience of evil, some experience of something that precipitates it. But I think it's a mistake. A lot of people oppose faith and reason, and I think that's a huge mistake because faith is the most reasonable thing in the world. When you look around at the world and you see the witness of the existence of God in all creation, in the order that exists, in the imagination that exists, it's much more reasonable to believe in that than it is to believe in randomness. Because, you know, if there were randomness, my goodness, one day we'd throw the ball up in the air and it'd come down, and the next day it wouldn't come down. It comes down because somebody makes it come down.
Well, one of the most important lines in Scripture for me is is faith is the substance of things hoped for and not seen. And it's almost like faith is the raw cement. So if you're going to create anything, if you're going to build anything, the raw ingredient that you need to start with to build it is your faith. You know, just like you can't, you know, build a brick without the raw ingredient, you can't create anything, let alone create a free and inspired life, unless you're prepared to pour out that faith brick by brick by brick.
Well, you just said it. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen.
Right.
And if you wait until you see things, then you don't need any faith and you don't need any hope. You know, there's a, near that passage that you're talking about, there's another one that says, he who comes to God must believe that he is, number one, and number two, believe that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Well, even if I can't see it, if I'm sure that God is there and that he's going to reward even my pitiful efforts, then I've got a reason to keep on working, because there is a reality that trumps all of the wicked things that I see around me, all of the wrong-minded things that I see, all of the evil people that I meet, all their evil plans. There's something that trumps all that. And it may not trump it today, but it will, at the last, take care of it. So I don't see, if you believe that there's a random world and you believe that there's no God who created and rules it, then I don't see any road, any place to go, or any place to end up except despair, because there isn't any reason to hope in that world.
It's funny, my second husband, who was firmly committed to the treats of the tapeworm, said to me when I explained that I was leaving, he said, you know, if you leave me, you will die alone. And I realized then, you know, death is one of the greatest control points. You know, if you don't do this, you will die, or you will, you know, you won't have health care insurance and you will die, and you won't be in a nursing home, so you will die. And, you know, and I finally realized, oh, because so many of the things that were going on, particularly harassment, is if I didn't go along with the plan, you know, I would die. And finally I realized, you know, death is not the worst thing that can happen.
Absolutely.
I had to make friends with death, because death was so often the control technique, the threat of death. And if you go through, you know, if you go through the popular media, everything's, if you don't do this, you're going to die. If you don't do this, you're going to die. If you don't, it's quite amazing, because I only watch, for example, TV. I'll get into a motel and I'll see, okay, well, I'm going to dive into popular culture. I'll do it at the gym, or the TV's on at the gym, and it's all, you're going to die, you're going to die, you're going to die. So if you can make friends with death, then you realize, oh, yeah, well, so what?
Well, you know, there's another way to look at it, too, and that is, before you can live, you have to die.
Yeah.
Before you can live, you have to die. And, of course, that means die to yourself, but you have to realize that I'm not going to be blackmailed by death.
Right.
That's what you're talking about. I'm not going to be blackmailed by death. So if I can die to the fear of death first, and of course, you know, for me as a Christian, I can do that. then I don't have to worry. You know, I mean, I come to understand that the integrity of my faithfulness is way more important than dying, living or dying. There are so many things in the world that are more important than living or dying. Than dying, that I have to pay attention to those. So. Yeah.
Well, you have to make friends with death. You just have to make friends with death. I'll never remember sitting at one of the worst points. I was sitting at my desk and I looked up at the sky and I said, "Lord, if the rapture came right now, I would not be disappointed." Another thing I wanted to mention when it comes to faith is the importance of miracles. And I'm somebody who's experienced a lot of miracles personally. I know you are too. And if it, you know, those miracles have made a huge contribution to my perspective on, you know, where power comes from and who has what power. You know, once you see those miracles operating in your life, you realize, you know, no power in the material world begins to have the power of the spiritual intelligence and love. And once that reality takes you over, that's it. You know, all these things get a lot easier. I have no idea how to tell somebody go off and experience a bunch of miracles.
Well, you know, one of the things that the Bible talks about is a good memory. There's such a thing as a curse of a bad memory. It's true because, you know, you forget the things that you've already seen God do. You forget the miracles that you've already seen. You forget the deliverances and the rescues that everyone said were impossible that came anyway. And so you need to punch up your memory when you begin to feel, you know, despairing, or you begin to feel like you're abandoned, or you begin to feel self-pity. You need to punch up your memory and say, wait a minute, I haven't been forgotten. Don't you remember this thing that happened? Don't you remember that thing that happened?
There's no doubt. If you start making a list of thank yous of everything you have to be grateful for in your life or have ever had to be grateful, you know, it gets to be a long list.
Yeah, and that's a very good cure for depression.
Yeah.
That's a very good cure for self-pity and depression. It is just to say, okay, I'm going to stop right now, and I'm going to thank God for all those things that he has done in my life. And if you start way back there, like before you were born, it is a long, long list.
Yeah. It's a long list. Well, the one other thing I wanted to mention is what I call Net Energy Plus. What I try as an sort of an ethical system, mm-hmm. what I try is always to give, if I'm interacting with someone else, I try and give other people energy in a way that gives me energy. Mm-hmm. And it usually comes from aligning, understanding what it is they want, what they're trying to accomplish, and trying to find a way to align what I want with what they want in a way that is mutually beneficial. And if I can't do it, I'm out of there. And I find it's very important to get out of there fast. But I just call it playing Net Energy Plus. And I think, you know, it really helps me to maintain and nurture my faith if I do that. Because if I can't create that positive alignment, then that's where the drain starts. And that's what's telling me, whatever it is, I'm not meant to be there.
Right, and you're not equipped to fix it.
Right.
You're not. I mean, there's some negative people that you can try and try and you can pour effort and energy and money into, and it'll never do any good. You're not the way they can learn. You're not the person who can fix it. You're not the person who can put the missing energy, as you say, to use your phrase, in their life. And if that's so, then you got one or two choices. You can stand there and keep pounding money down a rat hole that's never going to be filled up, you know, pounding money, energy, and time down a rat hole that's never going to be filled up. Or you can just stop and say, listen, I'm sorry, I can't fix it. I can't contribute anything to this situation, so I'm stepping out of it.
Okay, now before we close, Franklin, you know what I would love? Would you, in terms of sort of how to live a free and inspired life, some of the best books I've read are books I got from you. One is that healthcare book. Is that still available of all your healthcare interviews? You got to update that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's still available on the website. I think it is.
Okay. But here's the other, you've been writing a series of books that are, tell the story of how you and Susan and the family moved out and started to teach yourself farming. And it is a funny story. And it is a good, you know, it helps some people to, you know, to go through the nuts and bolts of living with people trying to do that. So maybe if you could describe those books.
Well, there are two volumes there. Actually, there's a third that's going to be published. I haven't gotten printed yet, but it's At Home in Dogwood Mudhole. And it's just a, you know, it's a chronicle of all the problems that we face moving out here and the story of, I guess, of how we overcame them. You know, and sometimes we haven't overcome them. But
right.
Included in that is dealing with each other, which is, was really the biggest thing we had to overcome. You know, there's a reason why families often don't stay together, don't live together, don't work together, and that's because they don't get along with each other. And learning to get along with people is part of the biggest lesson in that.
Well, I do. When's the third book going to be available?
There you go. There's one of my distractions. I'm hoping it will be available by this fall. But the first of two are available at dogwoodmudhole.com, the website.
Well, the first two are fabulous because they deal with the real issues. You know, to me, the story of, and because this is, you're not the only person I know this has happened to, when you run over your own dog and you're sitting down with your head in your hands and you're full of grief and you're thinking, how am I ever going to live a free and inspired life? Anyway, okay. Well, anything else you'd like to add, Franklin, before we close?
I just have to say one of the things that's helped me more than anything else is the Psalms. And the reason that's true is because there are no holds barred in the Psalms. It is a history of the complaints of God's people to God. Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this to me? And it also is the cure for those questions. So that has been consistently my greatest, I think one of my greatest comforts in the world. So
yeah,
I would recommend that to people. Just, you know, grab hold of those and read.
Yeah, and so many are David, and David was such an imperfect guy.
Oh, my.
But he had God's heart. He was an imperfect guy, but he had God's heart, so it fits with a lot of us. Okay, well, Franklin, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us on the Salir Report. You and I will go back to struggling with trying to live a free and inspired life.
Thank you, Catherine.
Bye.
Bye-bye.